Okay, I'd like to switch gears, if we can, to another event that you played a major role in terms of the farm worker movement, and that would be in 1968. Once again, we're talking about February and March of 1968.
And we're fasting.
Cesar Chavez begins a fast for nonviolence.
Yep.
And sets up his fasting headquarters at the 40 acres a little west of Delano, where the Union headquarters was. And during that course of time, he was summoned to the Superior Court in Bakersfield to answer charges that he and the Union were fomenting violence against the growers on the and their property on the picket lines, or to that effect, that it was a question of violence and union violence. I don't quite know I don't quite remember what all the different assignments were, but I do know that you ended up with an assignment to convert the Kern County Courthouse into
a cathedral.
Into a cathedral that would be worthy of this event. And I would like you to fill us in about that and what you remember about that.
Well, just on the fasting in general, I mean, if the march was my, my introduction to Catholicism, then the fast was a graduate degree. I mean, it was amazing. And of course, you know, you were the architect of so much of that, Leroy, and you know, one of the things I really admired about you and Cesar was this capacity for creativity within liturgy. I mean, it's kind of like appreciating the significance of contextualizing or of. Because the word's not used. I don't want to use that word because it's not the right word. But of appreciating the expressive power that lay within liturgical practice and the way that was adapted in the movement, I thought was just really cool. I mean, I remember in the masses, it was like... there was always supposed to be a general absolution. There was always supposed to be a long kiss of peace. The intentions were always supposed to be open so that everybody could, and so forth. And so it was a natural language in which to work. And so, you know, Cesar getting taken to the court, you know, the question was, so how do we transform the moment? I mean, and I don't know exactly where the idea came, but it was that we would see one thing that we had learned how to do. My assignment had been going around the state, working with the farm worker committees and organizing them to come to participate in the fast and explaining the fast to them and so on and so forth. So I was real comfortable with working with farm worker leadership to create sort of disciplined events, whether it was, you know, a march or whatever it was. And so what we decided to do was fill the courthouse with farm workers. Now, that could take many, many forms. some of them that would not be particularly constructive. And so I remember being up, the crack of dawn, we assembled this huge car caravan, to be at the courthouse at the hour that it would open, so that before anything could happen, farm workers would fill all the seats in the courtroom, and then line all the walls, and then form like a corridor, so that anyone coming into the courthouse had to pass through these lines of farm workers, pass through the walls that were papered with farm workers and into this room that was full of farm workers. And so then the question was, what do they do? Well, because, you know, nonviolence is doing, but it's doing nonviolently. So the natural thing in these circumstances was our fathers, Hail Marys, softly singing De Colores, and the people were so disciplined and so cool. It was amazing because just the presence of so many people acting in unison with that kind of devotion. And who knows, some of the men, it may be the first time they'd said a Hail Mary in many years, you know. But with that kind of devotion, just transformed the atmosphere of the place. And as the DAs and whatever were walking, they all started whispering. And it was like, it was this spontaneous whispering. It's as if they were in church. Mm-hmm. And it was the presence of people in devotion that transformed the space. And so when you guys arrived, I think you and Jerry came with Caesar. I mean, this was already the scene there.
That was the scene. And as we, as Jerry Cohn and I came up the stairs with helping Caesar, because he had been fasting for a couple of weeks and he was weak, and thousands of farm workers were present, and they knelt down. Were saying prayers. You could hear De Colores sort of wafting in the area. went into the building, and every hallway we had to go to was lined with farm workers. And as Caesar approached, they knelt down, and you could hear a pin drop. It was totally transformed. It was incredible, really.
Yeah, it really was. And simple. I mean, in other words, the simplicity of it, again, I think, is part of the power. You know, no shouting, no marching up and down, no puppets, no nothing, just the simple faith and unity and discipline of and hopefulness of the people. And and you know, as I'm sure you recall, you know, they called off the court that day. Mm-hmm. We had to go back a second time.
Mm-hmm.
And then they called it off, period.
Mm-hmm.
But but you know, talk about a demonstration of the power of nonviolence. It was really, yeah, because people would, and then people, there would be periods when people would just be silent. And then it would be a song, and then it would be a kneeling. Go ahead.
I don't know where all these farm workers came from, but they were there in the thousands. I can tell you that. And I presumed it was your network that enabled them to be present that day.
Well, we mobilized strikers, we mobilized the strikers from around Delano, of course. We mobilized, we had some contract workers by that point, right? We had Shenley, and there were others that we got to send delegations. We had the DiGiorgio workers by then.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, we had a good contingent from Lamont and Bakersfield. And, yeah, it was all working through those committees, you know, and that structure that had been created that, you know, made it possible to pull off something with such discipline. It's very cool.
Jerry Cohen, who was the general counsel for the United Farm Workers for all those years, has said many, many times since then that from that day forward, the Kern County Courthouse never felt the same to him. After that, when he had to go to court, he just felt that it had been transformed. It was a changed place, and that he had great hopes about whatever case he was working on. You know,
I totally get it. You know, we did a reprise of that in Salinas in 1970. under a slightly different circumstance, but it was when Caesar was put in jail for refusing to call off the lettuce boycott.
Right.
And we set up a vigil across from the jail, but I mean, the way it began was we mobilized farm workers in Salinas to do exactly the same thing, and they did, and it was very powerful. Of course, it didn't keep Caesar out of jail, but the interesting postscript is that the women had been particularly in leadership in organizing this in Salinas, and they had asked the priest to come and join them, the priest from the mission church there, that, you know, the mission to the, you know, to the Mexicans, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But it was a pink mission church, Cristo Rey or something, and he sort of hedged, but then said he would come. But then he didn't. He didn't show up. So after the court thing was over, they led the procession from the courthouse back to the church. And they arrived at the church, and he was saying Mass up front. And they had all their banners and signs and stuff. And what they did, they went down on their knees, and on their knees processed right up the center aisle of the church, right in front of them, and just were there. And then began to sing De Colores. And it sort of stopped the Mass. It was amazing. Confronting him with the fact that he was a coward.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. It was extraordinary. And I mean, that was not something we orchestrated. It was like they were outraged that he had failed them. And so, by God, they were going to go make their claim, and they did it in such a cool way.
Mm-hmm. I'm really glad you told that story. I mean, I did not know that. No. All right.
That's amazing. Yeah.
I want one last area of organizing that you played a major role. You played major role in many. I don't want to mislead the listener, but one that I want to focus on, the last one that we're going to talk about, would be moving from 1968, approximately 9 years, maybe 10 years, to 1977 and 1978. You can correct me if I don't have these years quite right. But it would be the United Farm Worker Imperial Valley organizing campaign for union elections with the Imperial Valley growers. You were in charge of that campaign?
Yeah, I mean, that came out of the... the ALR, I mean, that came out of the ALRB stuff.
The
in other words, the passing of the act, right? Because I was in Toronto doing the boycott, and in May of 75,
right.
I came back with Caesar to California, and then was assigned Salinas Valley for the elections.
Mm-hmm.
And so it really began with the election campaign in Salinas Valley, and then from that the continuation then was Imperial Valley that winter, and then the law was shut down, as you'll recall, in like February or March or something of 76.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and so then we went through the whole campaigns and Prop 14, and then went back the following winter to sort of clean it up. I mean, that was the 76-77. But I think the real intense campaign was the 75-76 Imperial Valley campaign, when we, I think out of 33 election, I don't know, we beat the Teamsters like in 32 or something. I mean, it was a wipeout, culminating in the Bruce Church victory that we had down there, which caused 3 days of celebration afterwards. Is that what you're referring to?
No, that's fine. No, let's talk about that. No, that's fine. Set the help the listener understand the Imperial Valley and the size and the magnitude and the um, and and the number of growers, the number of farm workers? What are we talking about here?
You're pressing my memory now because the ground was laid, again, I think it's important to appreciate the ground was laid in Salinas. And the fact that we had recruited, Roberto Garcia and I were supposed to be coordinating like 36 farm worker volunteer organizers to organize all that. And so it meant we went crazy, but it also meant that we had to really focus on developing in-range committees. In other words, we couldn't confuse organizing with marketing, with selling. We couldn't confuse. We knew that unless we were able to create organization within those ranches to challenge the power of the foreman and the supervisors, we couldn't win. In other words, we either had to win the power struggle before the election, in which case we would win the election. And if we didn't, the election would not win it for us. I mean, so the election was almost a ratification of successful organizing than it was creative of that, if that makes sense. I mean, mm-hmm. And it was real clear because we were limited in the organizers, but it was also clear because that was the nature of the industry. And so the reason I want to start in Salinas is because the first week of elections, we I can't even remember now, there were some days that we had 8 elections in one day. And ranches we'd never heard of, go out there and organize the workers for an election in 2 hours. You know, it was crazy because we were filing, Teamsters were filing. I don't even remember if there were any independents running around at the time. The thing was so high pressure. And as I'm sure you remember. But at the end of the first week of elections, we had lost enough elections and won enough elections that we had a basis for learning what would work. And we spent the whole day, I remember a core of us, because by that time I'd persuaded Caesar to send some coordinators, some folks to help coordinate the farm worker organizers. And so I had Nick Jones and Artie Rodriguez and Sam Baca and I'm not sure who else. But we had a good team there by then. And we spent the whole day in this hotel room with this UAW guy, because there were, people there helping us, analyzing what happened and why, and what happened and why. By the end of that day, we figured out what we needed to do to win. I mean, in other words, we figured out how to go about maximizing the points of leverage that we had in order to take power away from the Teamsters and the growers before the election. And so it included using the ALRB to do worker education in very aggressive ways, not so much for the information, but to demonstrate that there was a power greater than that of the employer, that there was this thing, the state, and that the state could actually not be kicked off the property, but stand up to the grower, because all this is all about power. I mean, this is not, it wasn't so much a challenge of convincing farm workers what was in their best interest. It was really trying to create enough freedom so that people could freely choose. And to do that, we had to neutralize the power situation. And so using the board very aggressively, using the pre-election conferences as theater to not only to get certain things, but to demonstrate that workers' voice would be heard. Then the timing of the campaign, so as to appreciate that once you filed a petition and had 7 days to an election, that was not the end; that was the beginning. Because you had to be aggressive. Every day you had to be proactive and have new activities going to keep the employer on the defensive. Otherwise, it would come back at you the other way. And so we really got it down to details. What kind of ballot needed to be passed out on Election Day, sample ballot that would encourage participation? Who to pick as observers and how to choose them and how to prepare them. So Salinas was our school for figuring out how to master this new organizing challenge, which was winning these secret ballot elections under the ALRB. The other thing that came out of Salinas were victories that broke the wall in Imperial Valley so that there were companies like Interharvest and others in Imperial Valley where we had won the elections in Salinas but would carry us down there. So we had a successful presence down there already because of the victories in Salinas. And thirdly, we had more trained organizers and leadership. And because it was the winter season, we could get essentially all the folks we needed to really power up on the Teamsters and the growers. So Imperial Valley has been the graveyard of farm worker organizing attempts ever since the 1930s. I mean, that I can count, there are at least four unions just destroyed themselves in Imperial Valley, beginning in the 1930s, when after the successful cotton strike in Pixley, California, led by the Taiwu Union, which was the communist-affiliated union that was doing some very aggressive organizing. They went down to Imperial Valley and to continue organizing down there, and it was over almost before they began. I mean, there was the growers all got deputized. There were the vigilante committees, the citizens committee. They had a Mexican front organization, and everybody was either in jail or beaten, and that was the end of it. They kept doing that. And the most recent was the AWOC strike in Imperial Valley in 1961, where they gambled on getting the government to pull out braceros under the Kennedy administration, and the gamble didn't work, and so that was kind of the end of that. So Imperial Valley was kind of known as El Valle de Lágrimas, the Valley of Tears, where all these efforts failed. Now, we had been in Imperial Valley since 1970 because, our Salinas contracts took us down there. So we had been building a base. We had established operations in Mexicali and in San Luis Rio Colorado across the border in Mexico because we had a lot of members over there, and we had created a medical service program. The beginnings of a medical service program. We had relations with the unions on the other side. And so, in a sense, I mean, a lot of groundwork had been laid for that campaign. So on the one hand, we'd learned a whole lot, and the workers had learned a lot from Salinas. And on the other hand, a foundation had been laid in the valley from work we'd done down there since 1970. So, and it was, the only place in the state where stuff was happening. And so we had this team of organizers, and we went after it it felt a little bit like Captain Ahab pursuing Moby Dick. I mean, it had that quality. It's like we were going to do in the goddamn Teamsters. And we were going to win Bruce Church Compass because it had a special kind of significance because of the way in which it had repressed workers in Salinas Valley in the election up there. So, I mean, all I can say about the campaign is that it was as near close to a perfect campaign that I've ever been part of. And not perfect because everything went according to plan, but because we had a team that was resilient. There was sickness, all kinds of stuff happening. But we had a team that was resilient and able to keep its eye on the ball. We also had the circumstance that the ALRB, as you know, assigned a special task force of led by Sam Cohen to actually make the board work, to make it work like it had never worked. And the combination of what we had learned, the groundwork that had been laid, the focus of the organizers, and the full support of the board, and by the full support, I don't mean that pro-UFW, although I kind of mean that, but I really mean vigorously, really vigorously enforcing the law. It's like they didn't know what hit them, and it was just one victory after another. And, I mean, they were hard-fought. Each one was very hard-fought, but we knew what we were doing. And you know, it culminated then with this big confrontation with Bruce Church, and you know, with people getting fired and the Teamsters going all out. And the night in the Imperial Valley Irrigation District, when they counted ballots, I mean, the whole thing of a ballot counting under the ALRB was like just nerve-wracking, because you'd be in the room or the place, and they'd be pulling ballots out, and it would be Unión de Campesinos, No Unión, Teamsters, and these piles, and you know, you were always like, whose pile was bigger? And at what point do you cross the threshold that you don't have to, that you're okay? And that Bruce Church counting was, the place was just packed. And when we crossed the threshold number, the place just broke out in cheers and aplausos, and the party lasted for 3 days. I mean, it was amazing. And then the law was shut down.
and we're talking about thousands of workers.
Well, Imperial Valley. I'm rusty on the numbers, but I'd say about 5,000, 4,000 or 5,000. And even more significant, because those workers then go and work in Arizona and in the Central Valley and in Salinas and in New Mexico, and so that it's like because of Mexicali, it's like a fountainhead for the farm workers that will take you all over the place.
Okay. Well, the interview is moving on, and I'd like to begin wrapping it up. And I'm going to ask you to comment on three points.
Okay.
In your view, let me give you the three points, and you can pick and choose how you want to approach it. What are the qualities of a good organizer? What are the ingredients of a successful organizing campaign? And how do you know if the organizing campaign was successful?
Well, you win.
Only if you win?
Well, I think there's actually three ways to evaluate success. I think the first one is whether you win or not. Because that really matters. But the second one is whether you have won in such a way that has built the capacity of the workers. In other words, that it has created organization that is powerful enough to follow through, sustain, and move on to what's next. So it's possible to win without doing that. And if you win without doing that, then you wind up in a defensive position from then on. And as we found out in Coachella Valley and in Delano, for that matter, in a number of places. So the first one is winning. The second one is winning in a way that strengthens the capacity of the organization. And the third one is winning in such a way that the individuals, that the people involved have had an opportunity to develop, grow, and learn in the course of their participation in the campaign, so that you come out of it with more leadership than you went into it with, so that you're conscious that all the time It's like Bob Dylan's song, if you're not busy being born, you're busy dying. That all the time you have to be building. And that means not just organization, it also means individuals. It also means wins, but all three. You have to be building, or else you start going backwards. Because it's not a neutral setting. I mean, the forces arrayed against you are substantial, and any time that you fall down, well, then they're gonna pick it up. So I think the idea that organizing a campaign is also an investment in all future campaigns is also an opportunity for leadership development and an opportunity for capacity building, I think it really has to be clear. And it means that you have to recognize that training is always going to be part of what you're doing, because if you're not engaging new people, either as leaders or as apprentice organizers, then you're not building. You're just spending down the capital you have. You're not building any new capital. And you have to be building new capital all the time. So, I mean, I think approaching it that way allows a lot of things to fall into place about why you would choose certain kinds of people, certain kinds of tactics, certain kinds of methods, because you're looking at all three, not just at one. Mm-hmm. And so your point is a good one. I mean, it's a very good one. And I think that, you know, good organizers get this. I think there's a lot of folks that run around, razzle-dazzle, you know, I'm gonna win this campaign, and wham, bam, thank you. You know, that's not good organizing. And you know, that's like, you know, it's, I don't know what to call it. It's like a one-night stand. It's not organization building and organizing. It's a different thing. So I think to be a good organizer, I think there's several elements. One is, I think, a clear calling. I mean, I think you really have to care. Not just care about winning, but also care about what is really at stake in terms of people's dignity and worth and capacity and all the rest. I mean, so there's a kind of values foundation that I think is critical. An appreciation and secure enough in your values that you're able to learn, you're able to confess a kind of vulnerability that allows you to learn, that you're able to create the space for other people to lead and learn through leading, so that it doesn't turn into a control game. Because in my view, control is the opposite of power. It's like in the effort to control things, people drive out the very people they need to work with them to become powerful. And so it means living with much more ambiguity and uncertainty, the confidence being located in your capacity to deal with circumstances rather than to have made a plan that you simply execute down to the letter. It goes back to what we were talking about way in the beginning about the creative dimension of this work and the need to be adaptive and always learning. So there's a values core that I think is very important. Then there's a dedication to craft. I mean, I think that one of the things that we were taught in the farm workers by Fred in particular, Fred Ross, was, you know, the devil's in the details. And if you don't have the patience and the discipline to master the craft, then you don't have any business doing it. It's like, you know, people that waltz in and sort of say, oh, I'm a big idea person, you know, and so don't bother me with the details. You know, they can just kind of keep on going, because you can't do a great organizing drive without mastering the details any more than you can compose a great piece of music without paying attention to the notes. I mean, it's absurd. The challenge is that it isn't just the details, that it's being able to combine mastery of the details with being able to go up on the mountain and see the whole. And it's that that inside-outside kind of detail overview tension that makes for a great strategist. And, you know, because otherwise what happens, people master certain tactics and then they confuse those with strategy. And so that's what they do. That's what they always do. It's what they know how to do, appropriate or not. So instead of looking at the circumstance as requiring strategic thinking about what's different, what's the same, how do I construct a stream of activities that can that would be likely to produce an outcome that I want, it's just repeating what we've always done. And that happens a lot. And that makes for stale organizing and uncreative and unimaginative organizing. And so there is this whole craft dimension, including learning. I mean, in other words, the building in learning in real time. That's a second piece. It may go back to values, but I remember asking Fred Ross one time, you know, what does it take to be a great organizer? And he said, well, you got to like people. And I said, oh, I like people. He said, no, that's not what I mean. When they don't show up to meetings, when they turn on you, when they let you down, when they, you know, it's not a bed of roses. You have to appreciate what it is to work with people and understand the limitations as well as the capacity for heroism. And, you know, if you don't get both sides of that, you wind up either becoming cynical and burning out or always finding excuses somewhere else for what goes wrong. So there's a coming to terms with human capacity and limitations that I think is so there's that. I think that hopefulness, I don't think you can organize without being hopeful. But hopeful is not optimism. It's not the same thing. It's not just, oh, everything's going to turn out all right. It's recognizing that things often don't turn out all right. But that unless you bring a sense of possibility to what you do, I like the quote by Maimonides where he describes hope as belief in the plausibility of the possible as opposed to the necessity of the probable. that being a realist is to recognize that the probable doesn't always happen, that sometimes the improbable happens, and that being open to that is part of hopefulness. And I think that it takes that kind of a spirit. I think, I guess, you know, maybe I'm sort of switching. There's the values, there's the craft. There is the sort of, I guess I'd say, elements of character, of which hope is number one. And number two is empathy, is, you know, a capacity to understand what goes on with other people. Both the good stuff and the bad stuff. You know, I always like the quote from Matthew 10:13, where Jesus says to his disciples, "If I am to set you among a sheep among wolves, you must be gentle as doves and innocent as doves and wise as serpents." So it's appreciating, you know, the fact that people will betray you and people will exceed all possible, all imagined hope. So it's getting that, and that I think of as genuine empathy. If you're not empathetic, you don't know what's going on. You don't have the information. And thirdly is a sense of self-worth, of belovedness, a sense of one's own worth and value, because absent that, it's really easy to fall into the trap of using other people to meet needs that you have that really are counter to what the work is and the mission is and what you're called to do, and winds up easily abusing power. Because you can be in a very powerful situation. And if you've got to sort of get the adulation and admiration and everything. You need to feed yourself that stuff, because you're not well fed in that way. It can lead to real abuse of other people. So I guess those elements of character, those values, and that sense of craft. I mean, that's the stuff. But see, I think that's what makes for good leadership. And I think what's different about organizing and leadership is that the organizing is a kind of leadership that focuses particularly on the development of the leadership of others. Given that, it requires even more of what I was just running through.
Good. With that, Marshall, I would like to bring the interview to a close by saying that some of the most interesting and satisfying experiences I have had over the years was working with you, and I thank you for that.
Well, likewise, Leroy, and I thank you for that as well.
Okay.
Well, look, I mean, I never would have wound up in the damn farm workers if it hadn't been for you.
Well,
so you get the blame and the credit, see?
I'll take the credit. You can take the blame.
Oh, thank you. That's a good division of labor.
Yeah, that's right. All right, Marshall, thank you very much. And I'll
talk
to you later. Bye-bye.
All right, take care.